Welcome to Cabeza de Vaca. Episode 23, Four Horsemen. I'm Brandon Seal. For the first 3 months of 1536, Álvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, Alonso Castillo, Andrés Dorantes, Esteban, and 600 or so of their Native American followers traveled down the Pacific coast of Mexico. They were backtracking along the trail of an Indian that they had met up in Sonora, who had sported a Castilian belt buckle and a horseshoe nail on a necklace. The Indian had confirmed for them that the artifacts had come from men, quote, with beards like ours, end quote. But the Indian had also told them that these bearded men had come with horses and armor and weapons, and had actually run through two of his friends with a lance. Quote, he told us how other times Christians had entered their lands and destroyed and burned their villages and carried off half of their men and all of their women and children, end quote. And the four expeditionaries now are able to see this with their own eyes. In normal times, the Sonoran coast is a lush, well-watered plain that, according to Cabeza de Vaca, was, quote, without a doubt the best in all of the Indies and more fertile, end quote. In 1536, however, it looked more like a scene from the apocalypse. Quote, we went through much of the land and found it all abandoned, because the inhabitants there had fled to the sierras, leaving behind their houses and fields out of fear of the Christians, end quote. From the expeditionaries' position of shared nakedness with the natives, they physically felt the effects of this devastation, of the food shortages it caused, and the psychological trauma it was inflicting. They met some natives who were so shaken up by everything they were experiencing that they just stopped eating. Quote, they were determined to let themselves die, which seemed better to them than waiting to be treated with such cruelty as they had seen, end quote. Naturally, this gave the four expeditionaries pause. Quote, we gave much thanks to our Lord God for what we had heard, because we had doubted of ever hearing news of Christians again. At the same time, however, we found ourselves confused and saddened, end quote. Aside from the pain it caused the expeditionaries to see this human suffering in any form, there was a practical consideration at play here too. The expeditionaries were worried that their followers would hear about the misdeeds of the other, quote, bearded men like us, end quote, and turn on them. Quote, we feared that when we arrived amongst the natives living closest to the Christians and warring with them, that they would treat us poorly and make us pay for what the Christians had done to them, end quote. So the expeditionaries had to restrain their excitement at the prospect of rejoining Castilian society and establish some separation between themselves and the other bearded guys roaming around the country. Quote, as indirectly as we could, we asked where these bearded men were, end quote. Once they had their answer, the expeditionaries announced to the natives that, quote, we would search for these men and tell them not to kill and take the natives as slaves, and not to take them out of their lands or do them any harm at all, end quote. Some time back, the expeditionaries had come to believe that God had some great plan for them, but up until this moment, it hadn't really been clear what it was. But at this point, they came to believe that Dios nuestro Señor fue servido de traernos hasta ellos, that God had been served to bring them precisely to these natives because of their unique ability to protect them from their Castilian countrymen. The expeditionaries had spent more than a year now as full-time shamans, medicine men mediating between the spiritual and the material world. And now, they were being called upon to mediate between two different temporal worlds, the old world and the new. Cabeza de Vaca and his companions were to become apostles to their own peoples, preaching the humanity, and to use an anachronistic term, the rights of Native Americans. At this point in his narrative, Cabeza de Vaca turns now to address the reader directly with the opening lines of his new gospel, and he opens full of epiphany and indignation, quote, from our experience, it should be clear that to convince these peoples to become Christians and obedient subjects of the Imperial Majesty, they must be treated well, and that that is the only certain way, and there is no other, end quote. With this new clarity of purpose, the expeditionaries seem to grow a little more even in status. The natives of the Sinaloan coast through which they were traveling began to come out of their hiding places, and they brought forth food and provisions for the expeditionaries and their entourage from their meager hidden stores. Then, the Sinaloan natives guided the expeditionaries and their traveling band along hidden roads through the mountains. And once again, the expeditionaries began to pick up momentum. Where before they had seen nothing but desolation and emptiness, a path now materialized before them. And it carried them south, down the coast, and onto the trail of the Castilian slavers. Finally, 3 months and almost 300 miles after they had seen the Castilian belt buckle on an Indian's neck, they caught up to their countrymen. Unsurprisingly, since the men that they caught up with were slavers, they found that their countrymen had with them a string of natives in chains on their way to the mines or encomiendas of New Spain. So although news of Castilians nearby excited the four expeditionaries, it terrified the natives traveling with them. These natives had already come 300 miles into what was essentially a war zone, and they had now made contact with an enemy who had shown himself to be infinitely more powerful than they were. Despite the expeditionaries begging and cajoling, the natives refused to go any further. And who can blame them? What exactly did the expeditionaries' native followers have to gain from going forward with them to meet a bunch of slavers? And yet, of course, the four expeditionaries weren't going to give up so easily either. Finally, they overcame the fears of 11 of their native followers, who volunteered to go forward with them. I wish we knew more about these 11, but in the narrative they're just numbers, so we can only speculate what motivated them to risk their lives for these four odd-looking medicine men. And to overcome their exhaustion at this point, from traveling so far and so fast across so ravaged a country. According to Cabeza de Vaca, even Castillo and Dorantes claimed that they were too tired to go on, at least for the moment. And yet, in the face of all this, 11 natives raised their hands, as well as Esteban. So sometime around April 1st, 1536, Cabeza de Vaca, Esteban, and 11 brave Native Americans departed for one last push to catch up to the Castilian slaving party, while Castillo and Dorantes stayed behind with the other 600 or so natives in their band. For 3 days, the forward party searched for the slavers, zigzagging along the Sinaloan coastal plains from the sea to the mountains. Finally, they found a fresh Castilian campsite, left behind by four horsemen, it appeared, judging from the tracks and the stakes that they had used to hobble their horses. Knowing that they were closing in, Cabeza de Vaca's party of 13 put in for the night and then went out for the slavers first thing the next morning. Then, on that morning of the third day, they crested a little hill, and down in the valley before them, at last, they saw four Castilian horsemen. And by the way, for any future adapters of this story into a screenplay, my recommendation is that you make the four horsemen's mounts white, red, black, and pale, respectively. And don't think that this kind of symbolism isn't on Cabeza de Vaca's mind. Remember, he had just arrived to this point of re-entry into Castilian society after a journey of 3 days. A journey that had begun back when the Narvaez expedition had gone ashore in Florida 8 years prior on Good Friday. And just to put the point on it, it was now mid-April of 1536, pretty damn near if not Easter Day itself. Cabeza de Vaca is more artful than I am, however, and he doesn't feel the need to overwrite this scene. On the contrary, after almost 8 years, thousands of miles, and hundreds of lives, Cabeza de Vaca narrates his great moment of homecoming with disappointing brevity. Quote, "The next morning, I caught up to the four horsemen. They were greatly confused to see me so strangely dressed and in the company of Indians. They were staring at me for a long time. So astonished were they that they neither spoke nor asked questions. I told them to take me to their captain." End quote. In the intro for this season, I drug this scene out for several minutes because it feels like it deserves that kind of attention. But the reason that Cabeza de Vaca doesn't dwell on this scene is because for him, this isn't the climax of his story. Remember, his goal was never just to get home or to be reunited with his countrymen. If that had been his only goal, everything else we've studied about the psychological tools used by those in similar circumstances suggests that he wouldn't have made it. No, this moment was merely his resurrection, his re-entry into Castilian society. Now, he and the other 12 with him, that is Esteban plus the 11 natives, were to begin their true work. Kind of like the way another man, 1,500 years prior in Galilee, only really got to work with his 12 disciples after his resurrection. And it's interesting also to note here that the number 13, according to Dr. Carolyn Boyd, held mythological significance in Native American numerology as well, as the number that represented the celestial realms. I like to think that maybe Cabeza de Vaca here was using a bit of numerology to inspire the natives in his party, just as he uses Christian symbolism to convey meaning to his Castilian audience. It's a great example of him tailoring his message to his different audiences as he slowly begins to transform from an apostle to the natives into an apostle to his own people. The four horsemen led Cabeza de Vaca, Esteban, and their band of 11 back to the main camp and brought them before the captain of their slaving party. After hearing Cabeza de Vaca's incredible story, the captain dispatched a troop to go fetch Castillo and Dorantes, with Esteban returning once again as the guide. Alone now with his countrymen, Cabeza de Vaca demanded a notarized statement certifying the day, month, and year of his return to service as the royal treasurer of the Narvaez expedition. And this scene always makes me laugh when I read it. Cabeza de Vaca still doesn't have any clothes on, but ever the Castilian civil servant, the first thing he does is demand a notary. It's good that he did, though, because this is where Cabeza de Vaca and his companions re-enter the historical record. We don't have this particular document, but from this point forward, we do have a pretty good documentary trail by other third parties confirming most of what happens next. Cabeza de Vaca spent the next few days talking to the captain and the other slavers, listening to them complain about how poorly it was going for them lately, now that they had frightened all the natives for miles around up into the mountains. The natives' abandonment of their fields was actually even more devastating for the slavers than it was for the natives, since it denied the slavers the provisions that they needed to move through an unfamiliar countryside. And the slavers, in fact, were beginning to starve. And in this, Cabeza de Vaca saw his opportunity to perform his first wonder, we won't call it a miracle, in his new ministry. When 5 days later, Castillo, Dorantes, Esteban, and their 600-strong band of natives arrived, they brought with them, quote, all the corn that they could in the clay-topped pots in which they had buried and hidden it, end quote. The natives also brought bows and leather pouches and bison hides, the types of goods that they habitually gifted to the four medicine men. And when this party arrived in the Castilian slavers' camp, the expeditionaries made sure that the starving slavers saw the entire procession lay their pots of corn and other gifts at the feet of the expeditionaries. Then, just as they had always done with their native audiences, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions distributed these gifts to the slack-jawed Castilian slavers, who were shocked by what they were witnessing. Four castaways, presumed dead in Florida 8 years ago, had just walked out of the wilderness on the Pacific coast of Mexico with an entourage of 600 Native Americans worshiping them as spiritual leaders, and then delivered all of their natives' possessions to those same men that the natives had been so effectively avoiding for weeks now. Of course, the Castilian slavers totally misunderstood whatever it was that Cabeza de Vaca was trying to demonstrate with this display. Rather than thank the natives for the food, or the expeditionaries for showing them how to treat with the natives, the slavers just got up, grabbed their slave chains, and moved in on the 600 natives that Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Dorantes, and Esteban had so kindly brought to them. "What are you doing?" the four expeditionaries asked, stopping them in their tracks. "Why in the world did you bring us 600 natives if not for us to take them as captives?" the slavers responded. "Are we supposed to just let them go? That's not really how this game of conquest works, man." Immediately, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions began to worry that they had miscalculated. Their goal all along had been to get back to a, quote, land of Christians, end quote. Now, almost by definition, their flock of Native Americans wouldn't be able to enter that land with them. But the expeditionaries still had a vague notion that once they got there, they'd be able to advocate for the natives' well-being. It had never occurred to the expeditionaries that their return to the land of Christians would consign their 600 followers to enslavement at the hands of those Christians. So quietly, the four expeditionaries turned to their followers and suggested that they return home, quickly, for their own safety. And yet their followers had also just seen what had gone on, and they were now worried about leaving the four expeditionaries in the hands of these unsavory-looking slavers. And they reminded Cabeza de Vaca that the way this works is that we don't leave you until we make sure that you've been safely handed off to the next group of people, remember? and we don't exactly trust this lot." The slavers, chains still in hand, started to lose patience at this point. They picked up on what the expeditionaries and their followers were talking about, and they jumped into the argument, saying, in short, "Don't be fooled. These guys aren't medicine men. They're just guys like us. In fact, they're actually down and out unlucky versions of us. You really don't want to be hanging out with them, much less following them." The natives refused to believe this, however, and turned now to argue directly with the slavers. Quote, "The natives responded, saying that the slavers were lying, because we four had come from where the sun rises, and that the slavers had come from where it sets, and that we healed the sick, and they only killed those who were healthy, and that we came naked and barefoot, and they came with horses and lances, and that we had not a greedy bone in our body, and that in fact everything we got, we turned around and gave to them, leaving nothing for ourselves, whereas they had no other goal than to rob the natives of everything they had, and had never given anything to anyone," end quote. That is a smackdown of historical proportions. But the argument here amongst the natives, the expeditionaries, and the slavers raises a fair question. Who were Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Dorantes, and Esteban more like by this point? Were they more like the Native Americans, amongst whom they had labored and lived the last 8 years? Or were they more like the Castilian slavers, whose language they shared? Danny Anderson, the president of Trinity University here in San Antonio, is actually the one who really clued me into the way that Cabeza de Vaca is playing with perspective throughout this whole scene. The narrative voice in Cabeza de Vaca's account flips from Cabeza de Vaca to his companions, to the slavers, and then back again, really highlighting the narrator's uncertainty as to which side he belongs on. Because by this point, Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Dorantes, and Esteban are something in between. They're liminal figures with a foot in both the old world and the new. And Cabeza de Vaca never quite settles this issue either. He only concludes, quote, "In the end, we could never convince the Indians that we were Christians like the slavers," end quote. But he abstains from any sort of positive affirmation on his own part that he and his companions actually were like the slavers. Because that's also not really the point. Mostly, the four expeditionaries want to get their native followers as far away now from the Castilian slaving camp as possible. But now that the natives had seen the slavers' motives so nakedly exposed, they were afraid to turn their backs on them. It was only with, quote, "much work and insistence," end quote, that the natives were convinced to let the expeditionaries go with the slavers. And this only after the slavers swore to let the natives go home in peace. For now at least, this was a bargain that the slavers were willing to accept. Because if the natives were worried what would happen to the expeditionaries if they left them with the slavers were worried what would happen if they didn't separate the expeditionaries from their native followers. Because these four renegade expeditionaries had made pretty clear their disapproval of what the slavers were up to, and they appeared to wield an uncomfortable amount of power over the 600 followers behind them. It felt to the slavers like they could have an uprising on their hands. And frankly, those 600 followers could pretty quickly overwhelm the couple of dozen Castilians in the slaving camp. But even after the natives agreed to go home, and the slavers agreed to leave them in peace, it seems that Cabeza de Vaca didn't quite trust his countrymen's intentions, and he felt the need to include the following disclaimer for the historical record in his account. Quote, "And so I say and affirm that if the Indians don't live up to their end of the bargain, it will be the fault of the Christians," end quote, by which he means the slavers. Or would it be Cabeza de Vaca and his companions' fault? Did Cabeza de Vaca really believe that a slaving expedition wouldn't try to enslave 600 unarmed natives that he and his companions had just delivered into their camp? That would seem to require some pretty willful naivete on Cabeza de Vaca's part. Interestingly, it's around this time in the narrative that Cabeza de Vaca notices that the expeditionaries have lost the 5 emeralds that they had been gifted back in Corazones in the previous episode. Those 5 emeralds, we theorized based on Native American numerology, represented perfection somehow, divine sanction for the expeditionaries' ministry. And here, just a few days after the expeditionaries returned to Castilian society, it seemed that perfection had already been lost. For almost 8 years, the four old Narvaez expeditionaries had dreamed of rejoining Castilian society. And yes, I'm speaking overly generally here, since we don't really have Esteban's perspective. But he had ample opportunities along the way to flee into the wilderness if that had been his goal. Despite the fact that in returning to Castilian society, he was, in truth, only trading captivity in the native world for slavery in the Castilian one, he too had marched every inch of the way alongside the three Castilian expeditionaries, suggesting to me at least that on balance, Esteban too might have been motivated somehow to want to rejoin Castilian society. Suffice it to say, all four of the expeditionaries were probably disillusioned by what they saw in the Castilian slavers' camp. Almost immediately, they had found themselves in opposition to the countrymen whom they had so longed to be reunited with. The expeditionaries felt that if the price of deliverance from their quote-unquote captivity was the enslavement of the Native Americans who had followed them across the continent, then that their mission had not really succeeded. Because their mission, their mandato real from the king himself, had been to bring the natives of this continent into the knowledge of the faith and into the service of the Castilian crown, not to reduce them to beasts of burden in the mines and encomiendas of New Spain. Because in addition to their new mandate as apostles to their own countrymen, preaching the humanity of Native Americans, the expeditionaries believed that God had given them their own sort of encomienda over the natives, to protect them from Castilians, and to teach them how best to protect themselves in this post-apocalyptic world. On the next episode of Cabeza de Vaca. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to check out the webpage associated with this episode on therivardreport.com, home of nonprofit journalism for a better San Antonio. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco, sound engineering by Stephen Bennett. The music for this series is entitled Apache, was composed by Kevin Graham and is available on Soundstripe. A special thanks to Father David Garcia, to Dr. Frank de la Teja with the Texas State Historical Association, to Steve Davis, curator of the Wycliffe Collections at Texas State University, to Professor Andres Resendez at the University of California, Davis, to Dr. Carolyn Boyd with the Shumla Archaeological Research and Education Center and also Texas State, and to David Dunham with Texas Monthly for all their support and suggestions. You'll hear more about them throughout the season. And for more information about us and our other projects, you can check out our website at www.brandonseal.com.